while we don't, we can't tell which ones are going to respond, and it's a very few, I think it gives us hope that we can make this happen.
Hello, and welcome to the Vetrospective Podcast. This is your host, Dr. Michael Kent. I'm a radiation oncologist at the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine, an animal lover, and like I said, your host. On today's episode, we're going to be talking about osteosarcoma. So osteosarcoma is the most common type of primary bone tumor that we see, and meaning a tumor that arises from bone. For those of you who enjoy etymology, osteo comes from the Greek word for bone, sarcoma comes from the Greek word for flesh, and oma means morbid growth or tumor. Put it together and we have osteosarcoma. But of course, if you, your child, your dog, or your cat are faced with learning what this word really means, it can be life-altering. This is one of the cancers that we look at as having a true One Health approach. In other words, what we learn about this disease in people help us treat our patients, and what we learn in dogs can in turn help advance human treatments. We'll talk more about this during this episode. So to speak to you about this today, I have invited Dr. Robert Rabune, who has worked on this tumor for much of his career. Dr. Rabune is a professor and the Maxine Adler Endowed Chair in Medical Oncology here at the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Rabune did his undergraduate work and his DVM at Cornell University. He then earned a PhD in cancer biology from the University of Texas Health Science Center at Houston and the MD Anderson. Before joining me at UC Davis, Dr. Rabune completed his medical oncology residency at Colorado State. He works with me at our Center for Companion Animal Health, where he is our Associate Director for Cancer Research, and he is also Director of the Veterinary Center for Clinical Trials. Thank you, Dr. Rabune, for joining us today, and welcome to the Vetrospective.
Thank you.
Okay, I wanted to ask you before we got started on osteosarcoma, what made you decide on veterinary medicine, and then why cancer?
So vet med was easy for me. My dad was a vet.
Cornell, right?
Yeah, he was a professor at Cornell. He was boarded in ophthalmology and large animal internal medicine. Mm-hmm. So I thought I wanted to be a dairy vet growing up in upstate New York.
Lots of cows.
And then I actually was interested in, I wasn't sure if I wanted to go to vet school or med school. And ultimately, I did some research work for a couple of years and decided that One Health was One Health, and decided to go to vet school.
And then cancer. What drew you to cancer?
Yeah, I mean, cancer touched me in many ways. I think my father was actually diagnosed with a brain tumor my first year of vet school, which got me even more interested in cancer. And through the basic sciences and through vet school, I decided I wanted to do cancer instead of dairy cows.
Fair. So moving on to the topic we're going to be talking today, can you explain to everyone, and even me, why not? I can always learn. What is osteosarcoma?
Yeah, so, as you mentioned, osteosarcoma is a primary bone tumor that affects usually large breed dogs. And also kind of affects people, usually younger age, adolescents, but occasionally older people do get osteosarcoma as well.
So how common is this disease in dogs?
Interesting. In dogs, we estimate that there might be around 30,000 cases in the U.S. per year. So it's pretty, it's one of the more common tumor types that we see in large breed dogs. As opposed to in people, there's only about 800 to 1,000 osteosarcoma diagnoses a year in the U.S.
What about cats? Do we know about cats and osteosarcoma at all?
Not a lot. It's a pretty rare tumor in cats. And when we see it, they're usually, the ones I've seen is only a handful over 15, 20 years, and they're usually old cats.
Yeah. So you had mentioned large breed dogs. Is there a reason why we think they happen more commonly in large breed dogs than in our small breeds?
I mean, we see a bunch of different cancers in large breed dogs, but osteosarcoma, I mean, it tends to be associated with taller dogs. We think that there are some genetic differences between large breed dogs that may predispose them to osteosarcoma, but we haven't nailed that down yet.
Something else to work on. Mm-hmm. So how old in, are dogs in general? You mentioned this, something that hits young adults, kids in humans, but what about dogs? What age range do we see?
Yeah, so there's a what we call a bimodal distribution, which just means there's kind of two high points of when this can occur. It's usually there's a subgroup that's between 1 and 3 years of age, and then there's most of the cases that we see are probably between 7 and 9.
So yeah, the ones at 1 and 2, those are pretty uncommon, but do occur, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So, and when we're thinking about osteosarcoma in dogs, what bones do we see this develop in most commonly?
Yeah, so most commonly we talk about appendicular, which just means the legs. Can be forelimbs, can be hind limbs, there are certain locations that is pretty common within the bone. So if we see x-rays and we see a lesion in a certain area in a certain breed, that unfortunately fits with osteosarcoma a lot of times.
And what about front legs versus back legs? Is there a predilection or a particular bone or a particular site?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit more front legs than back legs in most of the studies. Mm-hmm. We have an expression, away from the elbow and towards the knee.
Yeah, I never liked the on the back end, the towards the knee.
Yeah.
But yes.
Yeah, the forelimb, the away from the elbow usually works pretty well, is what we tell the students. But the other one, towards the knee is, it can be anywhere in long bones. Yeah.
Yeah. So I always think of it more kind of either up at the shoulder or down in what we would, commonly refer to us in the wrist. And kind of in those bones there and the like. Yeah. So do we know what causes this disease at all? What causes osteosarcoma?
No. We're looking at, a variety of groups are looking at genetics. There's certainly a breed predisposition that we see in certain large breed dogs, even more than other large breed dogs. And really the only other thing that has been known to be associated with sometimes surgery implants, like TPLO, if they get their cruciates fixed surgically and put in implants, sometimes they've been associated with osteosarcoma. But it's really hard to nail that down as well.
Yeah, it's hard to prove, right? Because if you have a lot of dogs getting this particular type of surgery, were they going to develop it anyway?
Yeah. And I said, the predilection seems to be towards the knee, and that's where the implants are for knee surgery.
Yeah.
So it's hard to say.
Yeah. And so where else do we see this, besides in the long bones? You mentioned our appendicular skeleton, or which means our long bones are, radius and humerus and the like. But where else do we see these pop up in dogs?
We can see these just about anywhere, honestly. I mean, we can see them in the jaw. We can see them on the head. We can see them in the hips or the spine sometimes. Most commonly, it's in the legs.
Yeah, most commonly. And then I know as a radiation oncologist, I often treat the ones in the nose also. So we see them intranasally too. And so really, because it's a tumor that arises from bone, it could be anywhere bone starts, right? Anywhere we have bone. And so how is an owner going to know? What are the clinical signs? We can't really say symptoms because symptoms are self-reported. So what is an owner going to notice if their dog has osteosarcoma?
Yeah, I mean, clinically, a lot of times what we'll hear from owners is that there was some incident. We were jumping out of the car. We were chasing a squirrel. We did something. We were playing ball, and we noticed a lameness. So a limp. And but a lot of times it's just kind of that little activity that kind of puts it over the edge, so to speak, because these are pretty painful. There's a loss of bone that's there. It can be quite painful for these dogs. So usually it's going to be a limp. Some dogs, may start acting off, may not eat as much. But most times it's just, oh, my dog's got a limp. And it's hard to tell if that's a soft tissue injury or if they may have, you know, hurt their ligaments or something.
So, yeah, this isn't really specific to a bone tumor, what you're describing, right? I mean, things like you said, like an injury or even arthritis, the dog is getting older because we're, you know, most of the dogs are older dogs who get this. So how would, like, you clinically approach this if you were, let's say, bringing your dog into your local vet? Are you immediately thinking bone tumor when the dog becomes lame after playing ball?
Well, I am because I'm an oncologist. But,
yeah, we see a stilted.
That shouldn't be the case. A lot of soft tissue injuries, again, knees, all sorts of things can cause lameness. So, I mean, I think just heading to the vet and looking at having them look and do an examination. Usually if we see like deep bone pain on physical exam, that will be something that makes us want to do an x-ray. But if it seems like it's just a routine injury, a lot of these, you know, it's reasonable. In majority of time, it's going to be, oh, let's get some rest and maybe start some pain medication and we'll recheck it in a week or two.
Yeah. And then if it comes back or it's still persistent, then it's probably worth getting a x-ray to try to investigate this further. So how else do we go about diagnosing this? Like, how do we actually decide this is a bone tumor? How do we decide it's potentially an osteosarcoma?
Yeah. So some of that depends on where in the country you are.
Yeah.
So here in California, we don't have a lot of fungal diseases.
Fortunately, yes.
They can look a lot like this on x-ray. So that can be, you know, painful lesion on palpation, on physical exam. And, you know, if you're in the Ohio River Valley and you know, you do x-rays and you see a lesion that looks typical of osteosarcoma, you may also have fungal disease on there. And so getting a sample of that would then be the next step.
So can we just use the x-ray and the changes we see on an x-ray or a radiograph being the technical term for an x-ray to diagnose this? Or you mentioned we might have to do more.
Yeah, I mean, depends on where you are, but I mean, a typical x-ray here, we may be about 90%, but it's not 100%. And again, that's if it's a typical location, typical breed, typical everything, we can be pretty confident on an x-ray, but it's always best to try and get a sample to confirm that.
Yeah. So if we're looking at an x-ray and we see this destructive and even productive type lesion on the x-ray, and I know this is audio, so can't really show you a picture or one, but they're pretty striking, right? And so now that we see this, and what would be the next steps that we would take with the owner to decide on how to proceed?
Yeah, I mean, if it's reasonable, we try and get a sample of it to see if we can confirm. Sometimes we can confirm tumor versus infection. That may be as far as we go. But once we know it's a tumor in the bone, then we know to address the pain and to address the tumor itself, then we're probably heading towards surgery. And so once we kind of know that, we will do what we call staging, is just searching everywhere else in the body to make sure it hasn't already spread somewhere.
So staging is kind of assessing the tumor locally and then seeing where it may have spread or may not have spread, at least to a best ability we have, right? So how do we go about staging it? What are the tests we use for that? You know, and where are we looking? Where is it most commonly spread?
Yeah, I mean, you know, everything, it depends on the dog and the client and the situation, but most times we're concerned that it's going to spread to the lungs or other bones. It doesn't spread very commonly through the lymphatics. So if we're looking at the lungs, we can do x-rays. We can also do CT scan. And if we're looking in other bones, I mean, we want to do a good physical exam, see if we can pick up any pain anywhere else. If we do suspect some pain somewhere else, then we can do x-rays of that area or a CT scan or a few other tests. But those are the ones we usually use.
Okay. And so let's say we have to advise an owner if we're going to do an x-ray or a CT scan to look for the lungs. What's kind of the advantages of each, you know, or why would you choose one over the other?
Yeah, I mean, our standard is usually x-rays. You know, dogs may sit still for x-rays, or they may need a light sedation or something like that. CT scans are great. You can see smaller lesions on them, so they're more sensitive. The problem in dogs, we don't have a long history of doing CT scans for chest. And so when we see little things, you know, even if we see what we're convinced are small growths in there, we're not really sure what that means long term for the dogs.
So they may or may not be the tumor. They could be even just like an old infection, like what we might call a granuloma or something, right?
Yeah. So they're very sensitive. They're not as specific.
Got it. So sensitive meaning we can find lesions more, but specific meaning we don't know if that's tumor or is that something else?
Yeah, in some cases. And we know if we take x-rays and we see a tumor there, or what looks like growths, that's a pretty poor prognosis, and it's going to guide potentially what we decide to do.
So how often have they already spread by the time a dog's diagnosed with this, or, you know, that we have a high suspicion?
The number that we say here or anywhere in academia is about 10%. I think there may be a higher percentage out there in the real world, with, you know, general practitioners that take films and then take x-rays. If they already have spread to the lungs, they may not choose to come see us because the prognosis is poor.
So how do we go about treating this? You know, we have a dog who presents for lameness. The local vet maybe has put him on a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug for a little while. They rest him, doesn't get better. So they take an x-ray and they're suspicious. They send him to us. So how do we talk to owners? What are our options for treating it?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest problem with osteosarcoma, I mean, we like to get a diagnosis, so oftentimes we will try and do finding a aspirate under ultrasound guidance.
That's where we put a needle into the tumor and try to get cells out, right?
Exactly, yeah. And, or, you know, we could do biopsy, but most times we can get our answer with that needle into the lesion itself.
Mm-hmm.
Once we are confirmed that it is osteosarcoma or that it is a tumor, unfortunately, the problem with osteosarcoma is that almost all of them have already spread by the time they're diagnosed. So
spread meaning we can see the disease or spread?
Yeah. So like I said, when we look on x-rays, the number is only 10% that we can see that have spread. Those are big tumors that have to be, they have to be bigger tumors to be seen on x-ray.
Mm-hmm.
But we know this tumor sends out a bunch of cells. We call it microscopic disease. So we know that the cells themselves have spread. And, you know, it's estimated that we need to see at least, you know, in order to see a tumor, you probably need a billion or more cells.
And a billion cells is what, going to be just a few millimeters or like a portion of an inch, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, there could be a million cells there and we can't see it on x-rays. We can't pick it up even on CT scan. So that's the problem with this disease, is at the time of diagnosis, it's in people and in dogs, probably 95%+ have already spread. We just don't see it.
Okay, so I'm going to break it out a little bit then. So we have a dog who comes in and it's got suspected bone tumor in, let's say, above its wrist, its distal radius, one of the most common sites we see. We aspirate it. It looks like tumor, not infection. We're in California, so that's unlikely. And we take chest x-rays and they're clean. What's our next step for treatment? What do we offer to the owners?
Well, I mean, that's where things differ a little bit in vet med versus human medicine. So what we try and do is we try and match what the goals of the owner are, what the dog, you know, it may depend on the owner, may depend on the dog, but we have, you know, 5 or 6 different treatment options that we can approach this with.
Yeah, so we're taking in the dog in the family and kind of holistically looking at that and trying to advise the owner on what to do. So what would be our most commonly offered tumors? I know we don't like to use the term standard of care when we don't really have a standard.
Yeah. So the, I mean, the most aggressive option, the you know, what's called, which I don't love either, curative intent option is to remove the primary tumor and then follow that up with some sort of therapy, usually chemotherapy. So we get rid of the primary tumor. That can be most times that's amputation to get rid of the entire tumor. Occasionally we can do limb spare, but only in certain locations and in certain dogs.
And those are with higher risks of complication too, right? So you always have to weigh the benefit versus the potential complications and risks.
So removal of the tumor, amputation is the most common, most aggressive way to treat this. We get rid of the primary tumor, and then we need to talk about slowing down those cells that have already snuck out to other places in the body.
So how do we, how do dogs do after you take a leg off most of the time? How do we expect them to respond?
Yeah, I mean, our not so funny joke is that, you know, dogs have three legs and a spare.
Yeah.
Most dogs do very well with amputation. It depends a little bit on the breed. I mean, really giant breed dogs, four limbs hold about 60% of the weight.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more dramatic when we have a four limb amputation because they have to hop and their head goes up and down.
And you notice that more. Your dog, you're going to see that their face is almost in yours, right?
Yeah. So, you know, we say, you know, four limbs are a little bit tougher. The hind legs, you know, may also depend, like things like if we have severe osteoarthritis, if we had bad knees, something like that. But in most cases, dogs do very well.
Yeah, and they're getting up really within a day of surgery usually and just learning their new center of gravity so they don't topple a little bit, right?
You know? Yeah, I mean, depends on, like I said, the, you know, if we get a, you know, 7-year-old lab that's a hunting lab that the bone pain hurts so much, usually you're right. They get up from surgery, they feel so much better and it's like trying to, how do you keep them in the hospital for a day?
Yeah.
You know, big St. Bernards or something with a forelimb, they may actually take a few days to get up, get around. They might need a lot more help.
So now you've already alluded to that we have to do more now after we've taken off a limb and that we have to basically, we usually offer chemotherapy, right? So how effective is the chemotherapy? When do we start it? You know?
Yeah, so I'll kind of throw in a little comparative note here. I mean, in people, the standard is to actually start chemotherapy before you remove the bone tumor.
What we would call neoadjuvant.
Yeah. And then they typically get chemotherapy after the surgery as well.
Mm-hmm.
In people, chemotherapy is it's a much more toxic protocol,
yeah.
Which... you know, it just means that toxicity is, you know, you can handle toxicity a little bit different in people.
Mm-hmm.
But chemo's actually much more successful in people. So probably 60 to 70% 5-year survival, and there could be long-term cures. In the dog, we typically just do the amputation or the surgery to get rid of the bone pain,
mm-hmm.
and then we follow up with chemotherapy. And so can be anywhere from 4 to 6 doses of chemotherapy usually.
And they're about every 3 weeks or so, right? So you're looking at a commitment and we're monitoring the lungs and the like. How effective is it though? You said 60 to 70% effective at long-term control, at least for humans. What do we consider control and how long does it last?
I mean, there's a variety of different studies. I would say the largest prospective clinical trial that's ever been done in dogs was surgery followed by chemotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
The median survival is listed as 280 days, which just means half the dogs live longer than 280 days and half the dogs live less than 280 days.
So what, 10 months or something? And there's a huge range around a median, though.
So, yeah, and the other way to put that is there's about a 40% survival at 1 year. And at 2 years, about 24, 25% of dogs are alive at 2 years.
So it's pretty tough. So what can we do then if, you know, let's say a dog comes to us and they already have lung mets or a spread to the lungs, sorry, using vernacular, and or if they've gone through chemotherapy and it's in the lungs, where... do we have really effective treatments for that?
No, I mean, that's something that researchers have been working on for now 40 plus years, human and dog. Once it's spread to the lungs, there's not a lot that has been shown to work.
So you already alluded to a little bit of this disease in people, and, you know, it's not as common. 800, 1,000, you know, young adults, kids get this a year, and 30,000, and I've seen numbers even saying higher sometimes in dogs in the U.S. getting this a year. How similar are they to each other? How similar is the disease in us, people, versus disease in dogs?
Yeah. I mean, it is one of the cancers that we see that is quite similar. So we talked about the age differences a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But in, you know, if you look at these under a microscope, they're almost indistinguishable. If you look at them molecularly and genetically, they have a lot of similarities. Certain genes are upregulated and downregulated. There's a lot of similarity. And then clinically, like we mentioned, usually happens in the legs or the arms. And it usually spreads to the same places in both species.
So really similar. Are there big differences besides the age distribution that, you know, we see, you know, between people, where it's younger people and older dogs most of the time? Are there other major differences that, you know, that we've found at this point?
I can't really think of any, but yeah. Maybe you can.
Not offhand. That's why I was asking you. But so what we're saying in a sense is what we learn in people, we can apply to our patients, and what we learn in dogs, we can hopefully apply to people, largely young adults. So this is actually a really good tumor to study in humans and in dogs then.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, we talked a little bit about the variety of treatment options that we can do with dogs. So I mentioned the most aggressive way, amputation followed by chemotherapy. But sometimes, you know, if you've got an old dog, or maybe a dog that already has severe osteoarthritis or something, you know, we do have palliative options as well.
Yeah, and I do some of those. So,
yes, you do.
Yes. So do you want to run through those for people?
I mean, we talk about amputation alone, just to relieve the pain. Like, dogs may actually come in with a fracture,
yeah,
where this bone is weakened, and they're so painful. We unfortunately, the options are euthanasia or we remove the leg.
Right then, yeah.
And so some owners may just want to get a few more months and not want to do chemotherapy for their dog. Maybe they have somebody at home that's pregnant or trying to get pregnant, and the secondary chemo exposure might be a concern for them. Maybe the dog, like I said, has got bad osteoarthritis or other, you know, orthopedic disease, and we just want to palliate. So we can talk about palliative radiation. We come see you and give them radiation. You know, almost all these dogs we're going to be putting on pain medication.
In addition, even to the radiation, I know we tell people we can usually get somewhere in 3 to 6 month kind of range of decent pain control.
Yeah.
At least about 75% of dogs we treat begin to control it.
I think that's the goal. With palliative, you know, we're looking at 3 to 6 months, like you said. Mm-hmm. Radiation works great. Some other medications may be helpful. But there are, most cases, options to palliate if they don't want to be aggressive.
So I wanted to bring us back to talking a little bit about people. In a sense, you've talked about how we've maximized the dose of chemotherapy, and despite the toxicity. And in dogs, we use chemotherapy, and we've also kind of maxed out what we feel is acceptable, even though we dose a little bit lighter. And we still fail, you know, and we fail 60 to 70%. If it's your kid, that's not where we want to be. You know, that's heartbreaking. And so where do we go from here? How do we move this forward?
Yeah, I mean, that's where opinion comes in. But
of course, that's what I want.
We sit right now, I mean, I think in people, like you mentioned, you know, they've maxed out chemotherapy. They've tried even more aggressive protocols, and it doesn't seem to add anything.
Mm-hmm.
Once it's spread to the lungs, chemotherapy doesn't seem to do much.
No, it's too much disease, right? And it's maybe resistant because you've already seen the chemo, and the tumor,
yeah,
in an evil Darwinian way, has figured out how to get around it.
Yeah. And dogs, you know, the chemotherapy helps. It, like you mentioned, you know, when we just do palliative, we're looking at 3 to 6 months. We're looking at more like 10 months. with chemo. So, but again, there are a subset, 25% alive at 2 years, that do respond to chemo.
Yeah, so for me, worth doing.
Yeah, so for us anyway, I think, you know, their chemo does work. It works in a subset of dogs. Wouldn't it be great if we could know which dogs that it actually worked for, which dogs the tumor doesn't respond to chemotherapy?
Because we have some fail early, even at a couple months, right?
Yeah, actually about a third of dogs fail right when, you know, before they, or right at the time when they finish chemotherapy.
And this is kind of new, this research you've been working on, I know.
Yeah, we've been doing it for a couple of years.
So how do we move it forward? I'm going to throw out the word immunotherapy to you and ask you to kind of talk about that, because I know that's something you've been working on. We've been working on together also.
Yeah. I mean, I will add that in addition to chemotherapy, there's other approaches, receptor tyrosine kinases, targeted personalized therapies that for other cancers have worked great. They haven't done much for osteosarcoma.
Yeah, because I mean, even some of the targeted therapies I have, I know if we give in the face of gross disease, i.e. we see lung spread already, lung masses or lung mets, doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
So how do we do better?
Well, immunotherapy's also been kind of a swing and a miss on osteosarcoma on the human side. There have been trials looking at checkpoint inhibitors, which have revolutionized cancer treatment in people.
So for those of you who want to learn more about checkpoint inhibitors, we have a episode with Dr. Rachel Brady talking about immunotherapy. But briefly, a checkpoint inhibitor is something to try to reactivate the immune system, reactivate our T cells so they're able to recognize and attack a tumor. Sorry to interrupt, but...
Yeah. They haven't really, for sarcomas and osteosarcoma in particular, they haven't really been shown to be a benefit.
So how do we move this forward? Because these are what we sometimes refer to as immunologically cold tumors, i.e. the immune system can't find them, as opposed to, let's say, a melanoma, which has lots of changes on it that and causes an inflammatory response. So checkpoint inhibitors have worked well on their own there. What do we try to do with osteo now? How do we tackle this?
I think there's excitement over immunotherapy and the approach to immunotherapy. We just haven't found the right one yet. And so as you mentioned, yes, these are considered colder tumors. The immune system isn't recognizing them, but there may still be ways to get the immune system to recognize them. So it may just be a tougher ask. We've got to figure out a way for the immune system not only to recognize them, but then release the brakes and make sure that they're attacking these tumors.
So combination therapies. I always like to think radio immunotherapy is going to be the key, but we will see, right? So another kind of question I have is, how do you find this earlier? Like, we find this pretty late in disease. Is there anything that we can think of or anything we can do to maybe try to diagnose this earlier?
It's really hard, honestly. Yeah. I mean, sure, if you've got a giant breed dog and it has a limp, you can rush in and take x-rays. The problem is, you know, if you catch it super early, we may not be able to see it on x-rays yet.
Yeah, this is a tough one. And so maybe down the road, we'll have more molecular tests or can find gene signatures, but we just haven't been able to do that as of yet, huh?
Yeah, I mean, there are several groups that are working on blood tests to try and pick up, you know, what they call liquid biopsies that may be able to pick up circulating DNA released from the tumor, but...
it's not ready for prime time yet.
Stay tuned.
All right, well, anything I should have asked you, anything I forgot to ask? You know, before I wrap up here, I want to just make sure if there's something we should talk about.
No, I mean, I will say that I wanted to add with the immunotherapies that there are several studies in people and in dogs that look like, even though they're cold tumors, that there may be an immune response. And so there are certainly cases where we've seen things like, for example, when patients get an infection postoperatively, both in people and in dogs, it's been reported that they have a better outcome. So stimulating the immune system in this tumor, and we've seen in clinical trials, I mean, we're trying immunotherapy here for metastatic tumors that are in the lungs, and we've seen some responses to immunotherapy. So I think it gives us, while we can't tell which ones are going to respond, and it's a very few, I think it gives us hope that we can make this happen.
Hope, and we have to figure out how to make more of them respond.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate you coming here today to speak with me on the Vetrospective. So thank you, Dr. Rubin.
Thank you.
The Vetrospective, as with life, takes a village. I want to thank those who suggested I start this project and everyone who has encouraged and supported me along the way. Particularly, I want to thank our producer and director, Danae Blythe-Unti, Nancy Bay, who is our program coordinator, our sound mixer, Andy Cowett, and theme music was composed and produced by Tim Gehagen. Thank you all, and we'll see you next time.